Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Tonight's topic is Ecosystem for Innovation, Environmental Cooperation between California and China. Anyone listening to the news over the weekend likely heard that the world leaders have made it official. There'll be no treaty signed at the International Climate Talks in Copenhagen next month. Instead, the deadline will be pushed to next year. But international treaties aren't the only movement on the environmental front. Last month, California signed an agreement with China's Jiangsu province to promote greenhouse gas reduction, renewable energy, and energy efficiency. The hope is that the agreement will create incentives for businesses in both California and Jiangsu to form what they call an ecosystem for innovation. How can Bay Area businesses benefit from the agreement? What can California learn about going green from China? And what do subnational agreements like this have in the upcoming environmental summit in Copenhagen? Joining me tonight to talk about these issues and more are in studio Mark Gottschalk, partner at Wilson Sonsini Goodrich & Rosati, where he is co-chair of the firm's Clean Technology and Renewable Energy Practice. He's also a co-founder of the Clean Tech Open, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to find, fund, and foster the ideas that address today's most urgent energy, environmental, and economic challenges. And by phone, we have Barbara Finnemore, director of the China Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's been working on environmental issues in China for 20 years and is part of the UN Development Program and was asked to help China develop the world's first blueprint for sustainable development in the 21st century. She joins us from Beijing, China, where she's been attending high-level meetings taking place as part of President Obama's visit there. And lastly, we have Margaret Kim, International Climate Change Advisor and China Program Director to the Chair of California Air Resources Board and Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency. She joins us for the first half of our show by phone from Washington, D.C., where earlier today she briefed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the U.S.-China Environmental Cooperation, Present to Future. And of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We'd like you to join our conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So thank you to each one of my guests. It's quite an interesting show tonight. We are not only airing tonight at 7 o'clock, but also tomorrow, as we have Barbara Finnemore coming from China. But let's start tonight with Margaret Kim. Margaret, you are the China Program Director of the California Air Resources Board, and you helped to author and broker this agreement. In a nutshell, can you tell us what the agreement says and why it is so unique?
Well, why don't I start with why it is so unique?
Sure.
Of course, this agreement came about with strong support from our U.S. State Department, when they realized that U.S.-China cooperation for climate change will require multiple levels of engagement. Much of this, of course, must occur at the national level, but subnational actors like states and provinces also play key roles as innovators, drivers, and implementers of policies. So we're not just talking about top-down, as that's what China is familiar with, but we want to promote bottom-up capacity building together with ongoing engagement by different stakeholders like our NGOs, like NRDC, academics, and private sector. And, of course, if you look at how California spearheaded with the western states and northeastern states, and now we're pushing for our federal government on climate change, so it makes sense that China will also may be looking for starting with experimenting at the provincial level or local level, a point in cases how they started with opening up their economy, establishing special economic zones in various provinces. So this model undoubtedly will be followed as they're apprehensive about economic impact of implementing climate policies, especially in these uncertain economic times. Now, to answer what this is about, this is the first subnational agreement between U.S. and China to cooperate in environment and energy, but to specifically also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This agreement will also implement the U.S.-China climate change MOU, which was signed in July. And you may be wondering why Jiangsu, but just for your audience, Jiangsu is sometimes called the California of China, as they have been so successful in developing innovative policies and green industries that have influenced the direction of national environmental and energy policies.
So is Jiangsu, is it considered pretty unique in China in terms of its progressiveness? Or
yes, and Barbara will fill you in more, but we've had a history of relationship with Jiangsu on energy efficiency.
Okay, and how did this all start?
As I mentioned to you before, we've had history of working, cooperating with Jiangsu province on energy efficiency, and we were also approached by the State Department, as I mentioned, realizing that subnational cooperation is very important. And, of course, our focus, there are a number of areas. There are seven areas of cooperation, ranging from exchanging best practices in climate, energy, and environmental policies to strengthening local government capacity, harmonizing standards, cooperating in energy-intensive sectors, data management, and the establishment of market mechanisms to development and deployment in clean technologies. There are various areas, but our focus probably will be introducing measuring greenhouse gases because, you know, you can't manage what you can't measure.
Sure. So how optimistic are you about this agreement? Do you think that, you know, China and California can meet the goals that they've set up for themselves?
Well, I'm really looking forward to creating a successful model for future U.S.-China subnational cooperation on energy and climate change that could also be used to accelerate implementation of post-Kyoto agreement. And we think this is critical because, you know, while the national governments are
okay. Margaret? Okay. Barbara, why don't we bring you in? We seem to have a technological problem with Margaret. Welcome from China. Okay. You know, this is always the danger in doing these, you know, international calls from all over the place in the morning and night. But luckily, we also have here live in studio Mark Gottschalk. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So you are the co-founder of the Clean Tech Open, and you must be pretty familiar with not only the Clean Tech Open, though, but also what's been happening with China. And do you have China and California? And so what's your opinion on this agreement?
Well, I can look at it from the sort of the private company perspective. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's been a lot of activity on both sides of the ocean with respect to what's going on with clean technologies. And there's been a lot of activity both from U.S. companies focusing on what they might be able to do in the China market and companies in China figuring out how they can actually get involved in the clean technology market in the United States. And to take it even a step further, you know, you mentioned I'm co-founder of the Clean Tech Open. So for those who don't know, the Clean Tech Open is an organization whose goal is to provide an entrepreneur all the resources they need to take a clean technology from an idea to a full business operating and hopefully successful. And the way that we do it is through a business plan competition to essentially get all of these companies the training they need to get them to build the business plans and then essentially to launch out into the world as hopefully a company that will do good. One of the interesting things that has come up is we've been moving the Clean Tech Open across the United States, and at the same time, we've been getting a lot of international attention from countries who also want to use the Clean Tech Open model for helping their entrepreneurs and inventors innovate in their own countries. And ironically enough, and maybe not even ironically, one of the cities that has shown a lot of interest in implementing this is Nanjing, which is in Jiangsu province, and has essentially invited a number of our finalist teams to come over to locate their businesses in Nanjing and to do what they can to implement sort of the clean tech open model in that city. I think part of the reason for that, perhaps, is there's a, I guess you could say, a friendly rivalry in China between Shanghai and Nanjing, which are not too far apart. And Nanjing is seeing clean technology as a way that they can differentiate themselves and really grow their economies.
Okay. So do you think that having a an agreement of this sort will help business in the United States, or do you think that it will kind of take away from what the United States can do in terms of innovation?
Well, I guess I'd look at it from two different perspectives, and I think both of them are positive. Number one is clearly we're not going to make any kind of real progress on climate change unless China and the U.S. are making tremendous strides, China more so than the United States. Having said that, there's both, I think, a rivalry and at the same time, I think, a level of cooperation between those two countries that can be driven by this agreement that will allow for that sort of cross-border innovation to take place and to have sharing ideas in both directions. Now, clearly, from, for example, companies I represent's perspective, there'll be a concern about having too much technology transfer going one way, like here to China, and then having less expensive products come back this way, as opposed to building those products here. That's a concern. But at the same time, I think there's a real recognition that, you know, the markets are active in both and that innovation needs to happen in both locations to drive this forward.
I mean, it's my understanding, what I've read is that actually China is actually leading the efforts at this point, or will quickly become the leader in renewable energy. Is that true from your perspective?
That's an interesting question. I would say that certainly with when it comes to sheer volume of manufacturing for things like solar panels, et cetera, that China is leading, will continue to lead, and it will be very difficult for the U.S. to ever match that. China has the advantage, obviously, of tremendous market size. And so when they decide to do something, and, you know, needless to say, at a certain level, it's centrally organized, they will go in that direction farther and faster than we can possibly hope to manage. Having said that, clearly, there is as much, if not more, innovation going on here, the government doesn't quite pick the winners the same way here as they do in China. So there's sort of an interesting comparison, I think, between the two that way.
Huh. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah. So because China is a centrally organized government, and because a lot of decisions are made to pick winners and losers, in a sense, as to what the standards are going to be in the market and the products and technologies that are chosen, there is a very good chance that that will propel certain technologies forward to the detriment of others. And, you know, in the U.S., it's a little bit more of a free-for-all. And so while there is, as many people know, a very heightened investment by the U.S. government in clean technology and some sort of picking of winners and losers going on there, there's also a very vibrant and active free market that's allowing a lot of technologies to bubble up regardless.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Let us go back to Margaret Kim. Margaret, welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
We were talking a little bit about the goals that China and California have set up for themselves, and you said that you were pretty optimistic, at least for part of what the agreement has stated, that they'll be able to meet the measurable goals. Did I understand you correctly?
Well, we are very optimistic,
yeah,
because unlike the national governments, where the climate negotiations may be complicated by other foreign policy issues, like between China and the U.S., states like California are in an ideal situation because we can focus exclusively on the how-to.
Mm-hmm. And in your opinion, do you think that we can trust China will do what it says it's going to do?
Well, that's exactly why, we have to collaborate in capacity building. That's what they call, and developing tools and you know, the how-to on how do you measure greenhouse gases. It's easy for us to say, is China going to agree to a target? whether it be post-Kyoto climate agreement in Copenhagen or national economy-wide cap or sectoral intensity targets or technology goals or what China said about their energy intensity targets by 2010, this will not mean anything unless you have the capacity to implement at the local level. So despite the lofty goals and targets that some of the national government in China may espouse, you know, you really have to step back and collaborate with the local level, and you have to not only collaborate and making it clear that the one ton of reduction in China is the same as one ton of reduction in the U.S., but so we have to be consistent. We have to learn how to measure. So instead of being suspicious and taking the approach of perhaps we're going to be competing with China, I think we need to build capacity. And I think California is in most ideal situation to do that.
Okay, well, thank you. Let me bring in Barbara Finnemore. Hi, Barbara. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Welcome to the United States. So you have been working on environmental issues in China for 20 years.
That's right.
So, this is a new time for you, isn't it, in terms of the progress and the initiative and in terms of China's attitude, isn't it?
It's a pretty exciting time to be working in Beijing. Even though we've been working on energy and environmental issues for 20 years, it's only recently that we've been able to tackle climate issues directly. And that opens up a whole new area for cooperation that's of great importance to both countries. And it's a pretty exciting time today because President Obama is here in Beijing. He's meeting right now with President Hu. We expect them to be signing a number of agreements on things like energy efficiency, renewable energy, electric vehicles, advanced coal technologies, and so forth, that are going to provide tangible, concrete progress on the road towards Copenhagen and beyond, and to build the momentum for an international climate treaty. And this is going to provide valuable opportunities for companies in the Bay Area and elsewhere. In the U.S., it's not just government-to-government cooperation. I was at a meeting yesterday that was hosted by U.S. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu, U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke, both of whom are Chinese-Americans, as well as the Chinese Minister of Science and Technology and the Vice Director of the National Energy Administration. And they're getting a jump start even before they signed these agreements, by inviting 100 experts from both countries who include business leaders from some of the world's leading renewable energy and clean tech companies, and experts from academia, research institutes, NGOs, et cetera. These are the people that are going to take the lead in implementing whatever agreements the two countries reach. And Secretary Chu said at the meeting yesterday that this is a public-private partnership. So one of the areas we might also see is something see the two countries agree to today would be something called eco-partnerships. That would mean perhaps elevating agreements like the California Jiangsu Agreement to the national level.
Can you explain what an eco-partnership is?
Of course, go forward at any in any case, but doing so to make it a national level agreement would elevate its visibility.
What's an eco-partnership, Barbara?
Well, this is just a name given to agreements between the U.S. and China, either at the subnational level or between, universities, city-to-city agreements, whatever, below the level of the national agreements that are going to be signed today. Because the two countries recognize, as Margaret said, that the real work is going to have to be done at the subnational and local level. So they've had some of these eco-partnerships before, and there's been a lot of discussion as to whether to include some new ones in the agreements that are going to be signed today.
Okay. If you are just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing Greening the Pacific Rim, environmental cooperation between China and California. And joining me tonight by phone are Barbara Finnemore, the director of the China program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Margaret Kim, the China program director of the California Air Resources Board. In studio, we also have Mark Gottschalk, the co-founder of the nonprofit Clean Tech Open. If you'd like to join us, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So let me go back to Barbara Finnemore in Beijing. Do you feel that the inability for President Hu and President Obama to come to an agreement that they could bring to Copenhagen really won't make that much of a difference in terms of the progress that each country can make internally? Is that correct?
I believe the countries are going to sign agreements today that will demonstrate tangible, concrete progress on the very areas on which any climate treaty need to be based.
Okay.
Efficiency, renewables, etc. This is going to help provide very important momentum for the discussions at Copenhagen and beyond. So it's important, even though the parties have agreed that they won't reach a final agreement on an international treaty
right.
at Copenhagen, they have to show substantial momentum to keep the process moving, and this will help.
Okay, and that's what's happening.
Yes.
And so and over in China, it sounds like there's a tremendous amount of excitement. But in terms of specifics, the specifics that Margaret Kim was talking about in terms of using, say, the same yardstick as everyone else, do you anticipate that there's going to be problems on that front, once they kind of get over the excitement of we're working towards mutual goals?
Well, the yardsticks are going to be different for the U.S. and China, just as they are different for any developed country and developing countries. What the parties agreed to at one of the previous climate meetings in Bali under something called the Bali Action Plan was that developed countries would agree to substantial aggressive targets for reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, and that developing countries, many of whom are continuing to grow their economy as, their people move into the middle class, will agree to substantial slowing of the growth of their CO2 emissions, eventually leading to reductions, and that would be coupled with financial and technical assistance. And both the actions and the assistance would be supported by, would be monitored, reported, and verifiable. There is a need to do a lot of capacity building in China and elsewhere to help them do that. But I think, again, these agreements that we're both the California Jiangsu Agreement and the agreements we expect today are going to go a long way in helping China to develop that capacity.
Okay. And what do you see as the major roadblocks or challenges from China's perspective?
The major roadblock right now is that the U.S. Congress has not enacted climate legislation, and that puts a damper on other countries' willingness to put their cards on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And until the U.S. takes its action to show leadership, because we have historically been responsible for the vast majority of CO2 emissions, it's going to be difficult for other countries to move forward. And that's one reason why it may actually be a good thing that the parties have agreed to delay make this a two-step process,
mm-hmm.
where they move ahead on some of the key sticking issues during Copenhagen, and then after the U.S. Congress acts next year, resume the discussions and move toward a final agreement.
Okay, well, let me move back to Margaret Kim. You have been in Washington and you've been having conversations. How receptive have the senators, Congress been?
It was a staff briefing.
Okay.
And basically, my objective was to let them know that, you know, while the national governments may be negotiating agreements to be reached in Copenhagen or Mexico City, but it is important for them to realize that there are other players, such as provinces, states, collaborating together with, of course, as I mentioned earlier, NGOs, academics, and the private sector.
And what was their response? I don't know how much you can talk about, but could you give any sort of gist for...
I think that they were listening, and I think that they realized the need for a local capacity for implementing once we are able to reach that agreement.
And have you done staff brief? I'm sure you've done staff briefings before this today.
Actually, this was the first.
Oh, this was the first. Okay, interesting. Well, let's go back to California, to you, Margaret. How well do you think California is doing in meeting the environmental goals it set up for itself, you know, aside from this agreement?
As you know, California has led the nation on vehicle emissions, low carbon fuels, land use planning, sustainable forestry, greenhouse gas emissions registry, and of course, how can we forget our AB 32, the first economy-wide cap for greenhouse gas emissions, and we are now working on the concept for our regulation. So, yes, we are moving ahead, and not only working successfully within California, but with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's leadership, we are now reaching beyond and trying to work with other subnational leaders around the world and exporting our policies and programs, as well as learning from them.
And do you, for California, what are the major roadblocks in terms of really succeeding?
I think the major roadblocks, the way I see, is, of course, we just need to engage and get the public support that this is important. We live in a globalized world where, with climate change, unlike any other agreements in the past, will require multiple levels of cooperation. And this is something that we would like to get support from folks in California, that we are able to do this continuously.
Okay. Well, Margaret, I understand that you have to leave at this point, so I want to thank you for your participation on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Wish you good luck and congratulations.
Bye-bye.
Again, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. Tonight we're discussing the environmental cooperation between California and China. And joining me tonight are Barbara Finnemore, the director of the China Program at the Natural Resource Defense Council, and Mark Gottschalk, the co-founder of the nonprofit Clean Tech Open. And let me just continue thinking about California and Jingsu with a question for you, Margaret. Barbara. Today in Beijing, according to Business Week, the Jingsu-based company Suntech, which is the world's largest supplier of solar panels, announced that its first U.S. manufacturing plant will be located in Phoenix. And I'm curious, considering this agreement, why not California?
Well, clean tech is a hot industry, probably the hottest one in the world right now. It's a competitive industry. So just as U.S. companies are going to choose a location for their facilities and areas that provide them the best climate for doing so, so are Chinese companies. I don't know the detail of that agreement, although I did meet the president of Suntech. He was at the meeting yesterday, and he told me this was coming. I think one of the driving factors of Jiangsu's interest in signing the agreement with California was to look for opportunities in California for companies like Suntech. I do know there was a big conference on solar opportunities in L.A., hosted by Jiangsu last year. So I think the opportunities are still there. And I think the opportunities are also there for U.S. companies to invest or to locate or to sell goods to China. One of the really exciting aspects of these national agreements, as I see it, is that they are going to put the policies in place in both countries that are going to open up the markets for dramatic scale-up of renewable energy and energy efficiency industries in both countries.
Okay, and Mark, I want to go back to Mark here. In terms of where the business, in the business plans, do the companies indicate where they would set up shop?
In a lot of respects, I don't think clean technology is going to be all that different from high technology, in the sense that a lot of innovation is taking place in California. If you're looking at what's coming out of the national labs like Lawrence Berkeley and Lawrence Livermore, you're looking at the private companies, a lot of the people who've been doing high tech have been retraining to start companies in clean tech, or companies are actually just changing their business model to go after the clean technology space. So I think you're going to see a continuing of that pattern and a tremendous growth of clean technology in California. Having said that, manufacturing in California is a very difficult proposition. It can be very expensive vis-a-vis what it costs to do manufacturing in other states. And if you add to that the fact that there's the stimulus program out there from the Obama administration that is driving a lot of incentives that states are throwing at companies to locate in those places, you're finding that there's very fierce competition, as Barbara was saying, for companies to go to those states. And I can tell you from my own experience with my own clients that there are a lot of states that are throwing a lot more money at them than California is able to muster.
Interesting. So what do you think that California is going to continue being a leader, or do you think that with the funding that other states are getting or giving and getting, that we'll see a new leader in the next 5 years, 10 years?
I think California will continue to lead. If you look particularly at innovation in terms of patents, in terms of venture capital investment, you will see California continue to lead. Having said that, clean technology is a little bit different from high technology in that it's a very broad expanse of different types of technologies, from things having to do with biomass and biofuels, which might get more traction in the Midwest than they do in California, to things like water technologies that could be coming from other places. So we can expect that all of the innovation will happen here. And in fact, we're seeing that it's a more sort of diverse spread of where innovation is happening. But having said that, the center is here.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing environmental cooperation between California and China. We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what's happening in China right now with Obama? What do you think about this agreement with California and China? Please give us a call. Join our conversation. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to go to an email. We have an email from Frank in San Francisco, and he says, reducing carbon emissions will take years, possibly decades. Geoengineering, on the other hand, has the potential of rapidly cooling the Earth's atmosphere. When are governments and businesses going to start paying more attention to these types of engineering projects? I'm going to ask you, Mark, to take this question.
Well, it's an interesting one and very controversial. From a global perspective, let's face it.
What is geoengineering to start off?
Well, it's essentially finding solutions that can affect for lack of a more elegant way to put it, the temperature of the world as a way of combating climate change, as opposed to changing our own practices, actually changing the atmosphere itself in a way that could provide the changes we need to avoid some of the disasters that will happen with climate change. Having said that, this is a very, very complex issue, and it's a little concerning to me to think that we have the ability and to understand the climate of the world and the way it can change well enough to be able to quote unquote engineer it. And so while I do think that there is definitely solutions that could be looked at as sort of an emergency backup, I think as a practical matter, we really need to focus hard on the things that we can do to our own practices and operations and use of energy and resources to really affect climate change that way.
Okay. And let me ask you, Barbara Finnemore, what is your thought on this from the China perspective?
Well, China has developed a real expertise in weather modification patterns. Whenever there's a big national holiday, the skies are blue. I don't know what their interest is in geoengineering as a solution to climate change. I think what they see instead is that the efforts to reduce CO2 emissions from their industries, which use up two-thirds of the national energy demand, are helpful to them in other ways. It reduces the heavy load of other pollutants that people are choking on in many parts of the country. It helps to make those industries more competitive, and it helps to move China away from a reliance on heavy manufacturing towards a more service-oriented high-tech economy, which is where they want to go anyway.
Yeah, and Barb,
so I think, as with Mark, this is not necessarily the best focus for either country, and they recognize that.
Okay. Yeah, and I'd like to even amplify what Barbara said, which I think is exactly right, which is, you know, the same things that we would be doing to affect global warming are the things that we need to do because we're dealing with scarce resources. You know, we can't just keep doing business as usual and using the same amount of oil and the same amount of coal and those sorts of resources and hope that we can just fix through geoengineering the impacts of what's going to happen with climate change. That's not going to work.
It's almost like the microwave generation, that we're just so... We assume we can just fix things. We put it in the oven for, you know, 15 seconds, as opposed to the way things used to work. Do you think that just this, it's more of a sociological kind of expectation that, you know, geoengineering could be the solution?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, certainly there is this view that, and particularly in Silicon Valley, and part of what's driven Silicon Valley is if there's a problem out there, there must be an engineering solution to it, and we just have to find it and implement it. Unfortunately, I don't think it's that simple, and maybe it's the, you know, microwave / internet generation that thinks that there can be the quick fix, but I don't think that's possible.
Okay. And Barbara, in terms of you talked about the weather, I understand that China has a Bureau of Weather Control, and they actually geoengineer against drought by seeding rain clouds. Is that correct?
They are trying, but they are starting to realize the limits of geoengineering, that sometimes it backfires, and that we simply don't know enough about the climate to ensure that the changes that we're trying to enact are not going to have even more severe repercussions. It almost never snows in Beijing, but I'm looking out the window here. I see snow everywhere. This is not normal. China's dealing with increasingly severe weather events of all types as the climate begins to warm, and I just think that we don't know enough. But if I may go back, I think it's really important to go back to your question of what's in it for California, this agreement, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. where does California stand to gain in this fierce competition, which I consider a healthy competition, by the way, that benefits everybody on the planet, to bring the cost down for clean tech, for renewable energy. You need that kind of innovation. You need economies of scale that can only occur when the companies from both countries and elsewhere in the world both compete and cooperate. Mm-hmm. And I think California has two advantages here. One, Mark highlighted, but I wanted to reiterate, that even though China has the lead right now, and that may not continue, in its ability to do low-cost manufacturing, California, of all states in the U.S. and maybe in the world, has that advantage of innovation, the labs elsewhere, this clean tech expertise that you're seeing develop everywhere. Nobody else has that. So the ability to develop new technologies is something that stands California apart, and that's why, you know, companies like the ones in Jiangsu are still going to be interested in partnering with California companies as they develop. And the other advantage that California has is, as it stands right now, California is the only state in the U.S. to have enacted climate legislation. They've put a cap on carbon that is designed to bring CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. That may you know, become more widespread if the U.S. enacts, which we fully expect it will, national climate legislation. But California has a jump because it's already moving ahead to implement that. And what that means is that it's not only the amount of stimulus money that a state can throw at, you know, foreign companies to get them to locate, but it's also the policies that a state puts in place that it's going to make it are going to make it attractive to clean tech companies to locate in that state. Things that California is already in the process of putting into place, requiring, for example, that utilities meet a certain percentage of their demand through renewable energy. This makes it provides certainty to companies. It helps to develop a market for clean tech companies to develop because their costs are higher right now. They need to be sure that they're going to be able to recover their costs. And so this also, if California carries through on some of these policies, it's going to make a big difference. And I can just give you another example of that. You may have heard that in September, the largest solar energy company in the United States, First Solar, signed an agreement with China to build the world's largest power plant in China. And I met with the head of that company recently and asked why. And she said it's because China is providing the kind of policies that we need in order to make that sort of investment. So I think California can move ahead on that basis as well.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. Now, do you think that the policy in China is going to, I mean, that we're going to start seeing policy in China that's going to reflect the progressiveness as in Jiangsu?
Yes. And in fact, two things have happened this past year. One, with regard to solar power. China is, in fact, the leading manufacturer of solar panels in the world, but at least 95% of those panels are exported to other countries that have these kind of policies in place. But China realizes that it wants to, needs to, has to develop its own solar industry, its solar capacity, in order to meet its climate challenges and severe pollution challenges, et cetera. And so this past year, it enacted two very large rebate programs for solar plants in China. So it's trying to open up its domestic market for solar power. And that provides opportunities to U.S. companies such as First Solar. Second, with respect to wind, China is also the leading manufacturer of wind turbines in the U.S., and it has doubled its wind capacity on the ground in China every year for the past 4 years. So the wind industry is growing faster in China than in any other country. But until recently, China had a requirement that 70% of any equipment used in a wind farm in China had to be manufactured in China. So this was a barrier to companies in the U.S. and elsewhere. But just a week or two ago, the U.S. and China held some trade negotiations in China. And as a result of, requests by the United States, they agreed to drop this quota, this local content requirement. So that's going to be a boon for U.S., California, and other wind companies to operate.
That's fantastic. Let me take another email, but before I do, again, if you are listening, this is City Visions. Tonight our topic is environmental cooperation between California and China, and my guests are Barbara Finnemore, the director of the China Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Mark Gottschalk, the co-founder of the nonprofit Clean Tech Open. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let me go to this email. This is from Claire in San Mateo. And Claire says, China is now the world's biggest emitter of carbon dioxide, but on a per capita basis, the U.S. produces much more than China. We cannot continue to point the finger at China for being the world's largest, biggest polluter until we change our own ways on a personal level. I'd like you both to respond to this, but why don't we start with you, Barbara Finnemore. Is this true?
Claire is exactly right. The per capita emissions from each and every one of us is probably the highest in the world, particularly our transportation choices, the cars that we drive, how often we drive them, and so forth. In China, if you go into a person's home, you'll be amazed at how frugal they are. This is a long-standing tradition in China, sometimes to the extent that they're shivering in the cold. I mean, when it was snowing here a couple of weeks ago, that happened before the government in Beijing had turned on the heat nationwide, because they don't normally do so until a certain date every November. So people were shivering. We had to close our office in Beijing. I've got 25 people working on the ground on clean energy issues and climate issues in China. We couldn't go to work until they turned the heat on. So, yes, and please remember that much of China's CO2 emissions come from factories mm-hmm. that are producing the goods that we buy here in the United States and elsewhere around the world. So it's there's certainly plenty of room for us in the U.S. to make the kind of personal choices that are necessary to bring national CO2 emissions down.
Now, I read somewhere that actually China's middle class is growing, and as it continues to grow, that there might be similar issues in China as there are in the United States in terms of, the emission coming from the people as opposed to just businesses, manufacturers.
That's right. China's undergoing the most massive urbanization that the world has ever seen. And in the next 15 years or so, the number of people moving from rural areas to cities in China is going to equal or exceed the entire population of the United States. And so just by virtue of moving to cities, CO2 emissions naturally go up. It's a known phenomenon. So this is not something that, China can stem or would want to stem, or that we would want to ask them to stem. This is just a natural process of growth of the middle class, and the people there are simply looking for the same, type of amenities, at least to some extent, that we already enjoy.
Great. And Mark, what do you think in terms of the U.S.'s production, being in terms of on a per capita basis?
Yeah, no, obviously we need to change how we do things in the U.S. Dramatically. And hopefully the climate change legislation will start that ball rolling. There are, I see them every day. I mean, we represent about 350 clean tech companies. There are so many innovations that are awaiting that legislation to really get out there in force. And then the one thing I don't think we can forget at all is, 40% of those emissions are coming from the built environment, from buildings and homes. There are a massive number of changes, and it's not just dropping solar panels on the tops of people's houses. It's a lot of things having to do with, efficient HVAC systems and appropriate insulation and, high value windows that do almost as well as walls in keeping in the heat in the winter and the cold in the summer. And so there are massive changes we need to undertake. And like I said, I think climate legislation will start to push hard in that direction.
Okay. Well, let me go to a phone call. We have Benton in Fremont on the line. Good evening, Benton. Thank you for calling City Visions.
Thank you. I just wanted to make two points. I mean, the first being, no one is really examining the reason why, for example, the White House at one time, at the request of Jimmy Carter, had solar panels. No one's understanding, no one's investigating why were they removed and why the first wave of the new green technology didn't quite catch on as it did then. And I know some would say, well, the technology has advanced and therefore it's making it possible to be even better than it was before. But we often hear that, and it really is, no one's really explaining why. Also, the other point that I wanted to, or comment I wanted to make, was that, no one's really addressing the environmental degradation of the green economy, especially even solar panels, where, for example, the inert earth that is created, where not even natural vegetation can grow due to the waste of the in the production process of solar panels in China. So
you know what,
in a way, it's like,
Yeah, Benton, I think as you're kind of tagging on to what Mark was alluding to, why don't we go back and hear from him? Thank you for the call.
Yeah, so I think so let me address both those questions. The first one's a pretty simple one in the sense that there was obviously a big philosophical change between the Carter administration and the Reagan administration about how to deal with issues regarding the use of energy and resources, and magically those solar panels disappeared. It's interesting and not surprising that a lot of the technologies that we were seeing in the 70s have made a comeback. Are things that underpin a lot of the new technologies we're seeing now. You know, having said that, there's sort of two things that are the drivers of what's going on. The one that's a constant is that I think we will continue to see high oil prices and higher over time, and that the economics of that are going to drive what we see with respect to renewable energy. And then the second thing is government involvement, whether it's by tax credits or through stimulus and other measures, certainly in this administration will continue to drive that. You know, the thing you worry about is those things going away and the market collapsing, and that's something that we need to look out for.
And do you think in terms of California's, you know, very fragile economy, I mean, do you think that the kind of new business that's going to come in will be helping it, or do you think that there's a good chance that they won't succeed and it's going to basically put us deeper in the hole?
I think the innovation is here. It's here to stay. It's going to be very beneficial. I think the caller's point, though, about what kinds of manufacturing will lead to the appropriate clean technology products and whether those manufacturing processes are as clean as they need to be in order to not create other problems while we do this is a very good one. And just to do a little bit of sort of promotion for the Clean Tech Open, you know, one of the things that we do in training the innovative companies that come through the Clean Tech Open is to actually have them build from day one sustainability practices into exactly what they're doing so that the company is not just green by its products, but it's green by its operations.
Barbara, is a similar approach taking place in China?
What needs to be done, I agree with the caller completely, is to look at the life cycle analysis of different types of technologies. What are the environmental impacts of manufacturing of the materials that are being used in the technologies? How are they operating? And also, how are they discarded? And there has been an issue for solar power. And what I'm, you know, hoping to see and starting to see is a development of new technologies using different types of materials, and new practices that are going to capture and recycle the materials before they are just dumped. And I think that was one of the reasons, the development of technologies along this line that led China to choose this company, First Solar, for their world's biggest power plant, because, at least according to the company itself, I haven't reviewed any of this, they have developed a completely closed system that recycles all of the materials.
Okay. Well, let me, we're coming to the top of the hour, so let me actually ask each of you to reply to this question. What trends do you see among clean tech startups in terms of, like, what are the hot categories that companies are focusing on? I mean, we've talked about solar and wind, but maybe, Barbara, do you want to go first in China, and then we'll follow up with Mark?
I would just like to say that we have started another NGO based in California called the China-U.S. Energy Efficiency Alliance. It's a public-private partnership. It's an opportunity for companies and government, state government, utilities, and other key stakeholders to hook into opportunities in China. We've been focusing on opportunities in the industrial sector because that's where China's key energy efficiency efforts have taken place, but we're starting to move into the building sector because, in answer to your question, I think that the hottest area for growth of clean tech in China is going to be technologies and services relating to improving the energy efficiency of buildings. And so we've set up this operation. We have series of roundtables, we have monthly calls, we have opportunities in China for companies that are really have key leading technologies in this area.
You know, when I was in China a couple of years ago, Barbara, and one of the things that was really scary in terms of building was just the materials that were being used. I mean, there were still, if I remember, like asbestos, and I mean, there was just some really awful materials being used, and that seems to go against the whole green, clean. Is that something that you see getting cleaned up as they start, moving into this building service category that you're talking about?
That is a concern, but we do see a real growth in interest and a growth in construction of green buildings in China. We help to manage the construction and operation of the first LEED certified green building in China, which uses 75% less energy and 60% less water. Most recently, last year for the Beijing Olympics, we helped Department of Energy to help China to green the Olympic Village, where all the athletes were housed, and that's now become one of the most exclusive residential complexes in Beijing, and it earned a LEED certification for neighborhood development, community development, which is the first of its kind in China. So, yes, we do see, and we're helping to promote strong growth in green building development in China.
Okay. And Mark?
Yeah, so let me use this by way of talking about the Clean Tech Open. So
please
for
do.
Those who don't know, the final award ceremony for the National Clean Tech Open is tomorrow at the Masonic Center up on Nob Hill. All day long, with an expo starting at 10 a.m. in the morning, and then the awards being given out tomorrow night. And there are going to be probably about 100 innovative new clean tech companies that will be showing their wares there. That alone should give you a very good idea of a lot of the new ideas that you're seeing in clean technology, things that are going to be big soon and important trends to follow. Following up on what Barbara was saying, certainly the built environment is a critical area that will see a lot of advancement. You know, we have clients like Sirius Materials and CalStar Cement that are looking for much better ways of doing wallboard and concrete and things that are obviously big greenhouse gas emitters. But you're going to see things in the water area. You're going to see energy efficiency. You're going to see some great changes in transportation technology. So I encourage your listeners to make it up to the Masonic Auditorium tomorrow, because I think they'll find it a very fun, interesting, and educational experience, if not also one that where in this down economy you feel a lot of optimism and hope and excitement.
Do you already know who's going to win?
I can't say.
Okay. Well, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank our wonderful guests, Barbara Finnemore, the Director of China Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joining us from Beijing. Thank you so much, Barbara.
My pleasure.
And Mark Gottschalk, the co-founder of the nonprofit Clean Tech Open, joining us here in the studio. Thank you so much.
My pleasure as well.
Again, if you're interested in learning more about the clean tech industry and seeing the winners of tomorrow night's Clean Tech Open competition, visit the organization's website at www.cleantechopen.com. And you can find that link as well as other links that we've talked about tonight at the www.cityvisionsradio.com. For a link to this program and other City Vision shows, and also to let you know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, as I mentioned, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Thank you, Eric. And tonight's producer was David Mumford. Great job, David. Thank you very much. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Brian Moran is the senior producer. Our contributing producers are Ann Maley, Maya Mirsky, Kevin O'Connell, and Sarah Wood, who will be starting next week. Daphne Humes manages our website. Join my co-host Joseph Pache next week when the topic will be, what kind of sanctuary? A tug of war over what to do with documented youth in San Francisco. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week. Thank you.